This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America on this edition of the program. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, India's popular nationalist leader, won a sweeping mandate for a second five-year term. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. More than 600 million votes were cast over 39 days across the world's largest democracy, showing that Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, trounced the opposition Congress Party, which had once dominated Indian politics and had hoped for a comeback. BJP easily secured a majority of the 543 elected seats in Parliament. Analysts say that how Mr. Modi uses his mandate in a country on track to become the world's most populous in 2022 will have global repercussions. He has pushed India to be at the center of the global discussion on issues including climate change and trade. U.S. President Donald Trump congratulated Modi and said that, quote, great things are in store for the U.S.-India partnership, unquote. However, late last week, Mr. Trump announced the South Asian country's removal from a special trade program known as the Generalized System of Preferences, which exempted Indian goods worth more than $6 billion from import duties in 2018. Furthermore, Mr. Modi's opponents are concerned that he is moving India, seen as a secular nation, toward a system dominated by the Hindu majority. Mr. Modi and the BJP leadership took a populist tack in the election, fanning nationalist and Hindu religious pride by trumpeting a recent military confrontation with Pakistan. So, what effect will Modi's victory have on India's sizable Muslim community? The BJP does not have a single Muslim member of parliament among its 303 lawmakers. How will Modi conduct relations with neighboring nuclear-armed Pakistan? Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan was not invited to Modi's swearing-in ceremony. With us to analyze the domestic and international ramifications of Narendra Modi's victory in India are two distinguished analysts. Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. That's a nonpartisan policy forum based here in Washington. And Nidhi Upadhyay. She's Associate Director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council. That's also a policy group based here in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program. Well, let me start with you, Michael. What's your take on the significance of Modi's victory? What were the factors, in your view, responsible for his landslide?
Well, I think there are a number of factors at play. I should say that it was not really a surprise that he and his party won, but it was a surprise that he won and his party won by such a large margin, comparable to the margin of victory back in 2014. You know, a combination of factors. One is just that Modi himself is an incredibly popular politician. He himself is an individual. He's just remained popular over the last 5 years, even at a time when his party had suffered a number of losses in state elections. There had been struggles with the government's economic reform plan over the last 2 years. And so there had been some significant blows to the party, and yet Modi himself has never lost his popularity. And, you know, we used to hear Ronald Reagan referred to as a Teflon president because criticism and bad things just bounced right off him. It didn't affect his popularity. I would argue that Modi is sort of similar in that regard. And then you could look at a lot of other factors as well, particularly in opposition that simply could not mount an effective campaign. It couldn't cobble together a strong enough coalition to be able to contest the ruling party. So I think that's another factor as well.
Turning to you, Nidhi Upadhyay, for your take on the significance of Modi's second victory, why has the BJP outplayed its rivals?
I would definitely want to echo Michael's thoughts on the surprise element that was the margin with which Modi won the elections. But going off of what Michael said, definitely a weak opposition party was what played a major role in Prime Minister Modi's win for his party. The other thing that I would highlight is the strong national security agenda that he highlighted right after the tensions in February with Pakistan. It sort of bolstered his support in the country. And despite a lot of economic setbacks that the country has faced over the first five-year term, there are certain things that he's done well for the country in the economic development space. For example, promoting the interim budget focused on farmers. The budget last year was focused on women's development. The Clean India Initiative or the Swachh Bharat Initiative that he has launched. The launch of the Goods and Services Tax, which took over a decade to get passed in both houses. So I think there are a lot of factors that have played in his favor, despite all the setbacks that he had over the last 5 years. And that's led to his win.
Well, let's talk about what happened to the venerable Congress Party of Nehru, Michael Kugelman. What does it stand for, in a sense, ideologically, and why do you think they were so easily trounced?
And, you know, we have to remember that not only were they trounced in 2019, they were also trounced in 2014. So I think there was a lot of soul-searching within the Congress Party back then as to what could be done to improve the party's prospects the next time around. And we see that whatever soul-searching was done clearly did not work. And I think that, you know, one of the big questions is that Congress is associated with the family that runs it, the Gandhi family. And, you know, it represents this type of dynastic politics that the BJP, and particularly Modi, has tried to use as a way of contrasting himself and his party with Congress. That's a big factor there. And I think that for me, the question is Rahul Gandhi himself, the leader of the party. What does he do? My own view as an analyst watching him from afar, sometimes I just get the sense that he didn't really seem comfortable being a politician, and that in effect that he was in politics not because he wanted to, but because he had to, because of his family and his lineage. So one of the interesting parts of the campaign was several months ago, Rahul's sister, Priyanka, took on a more prominent role trying to launch some momentum for the Congress, and that worked. She is seen as being a bit more charismatic and popular than her brother, but I think there's a big question moving forward as to the very leadership of the party. I mean, is Rahul really up for this? Can he allow the party to make a comeback? Certainly it's not going to go away. I think that's the most important takeaway, but its challenges have been compounded given that it suffered two straight shellackings, which is truly extraordinary.
It seems like Rahul Gandhi is, in a sense, the opposite of Modi, who you both said was rather charismatic. His personality, even more than the party, drew people. How do you interpret the loss of the Congress Party, Nidhi?
I think this time's loss was just a few seats better than the one in 2014, but it was still in the double digits. And that is definitely something that they need to think about in re-strategizing of how the party moves forward. A few days ago, they announced the re-election of his mother, Sonia Gandhi, as the chairperson of the United Progressive Alliance, their coalition. But we're still unclear as to what Rahul Gandhi's next step is going to be. Is he going to continue staying as the president of the Congress Party? There are rumors he's indicated that he would like to step down, but the senior leadership of the party is supporting him to stay on as the president and continue working on sort of developing a new strategy. And like Michael said, the inclusion of Priyanka Gandhi Vadra in the equation of the Gandhi family would indicate a slight change towards how they're looking at the next round of elections. But many analysts have observed that the continuous involvement of the Gandhi family as the leaders of the party has in some ways caused its downfall. And they definitely need to think of what they need to do to overcome this obstacle and sort of infuse younger or different leaders from not basically the family into the party to see how it goes in the future.
Well, back to you, Michael Kugelman. We're talking about the Congress Party, not only because it was such an influential party and was in power for so many years, but also because it's important for democracy to have a strong opposition. And now you have the BJP in power in both the upper and lower chambers of parliament, and there's not a lot of checks on them, so that could be worrisome. How do you see that, and particularly the charge that the BJP is pushing Hindu nationalism in a secular republic, and to what extent that is perhaps dangerous?
The BJP will be leading the government with its very friendly coalitions, and it has a fresh mandate to do the things that it said that it would want to do. And it doesn't only involve Hindu nationalism. I mean, there's been so much focus on the Hindu nationalism issue, as there should be. But, you know, I would argue that one thing this government is going to do, and the Modi 2.0, I should say, I think it's going to try to give the economic reform another try. I mean, it was elected with a huge mandate to carry that out back in 2014, but there were a number of setbacks. It didn't achieve as much as it wanted to do. So I think now it feels it has another mandate to give it another go, perhaps with some adjustments. So I think that will be one of the big focus areas. But certainly the issue of Hindu nationalism, the BJP, by its very nature, is a party that is conservative socially and supports this idea of elevating Hinduism to a very prominent spot in society and in politics. So, you know, what we've heard over the last 2 years is not new. It's always been like that. But I do think that the BJP really scaled up that focus over the last 2 years, particularly after its economic reform plan started to flounder. I felt that it had a need to really energize its base once again. What better way to do that than to sort of focus more on the social agenda? Yeah, I imagine that we could see more of what we had seen over the last few years of the Modi government's first term. But what type of direction it goes in on this issue, I think, does remain to be seen. And it's not just Modi. You have several very senior officials in the BJP who have said some, in my view, to be very candid, some very nasty, even odious things, including, you know, Amit Shah, who's top official in the BJP. He said some extremely terrible things about Muslims. Rhetorically, you could talk about how maybe he was saying things on the campaign trail. It doesn't really mean anything at the end of the day. But no, I don't know. I mean, the fact of the matter is you have some very senior people in this party that are given to some very troubling points of view. And now that they have a fresh mandate in power once again, you have to worry that that could translate itself into policy, which I think is quite troubling.
So how do you see that question, Nidhi Upadhyay, in terms of the fact that the Congress Party is rather weak and you have the BJP and its allies in prominent positions in the upper and lower chambers, and this use of Hindu nationalism, which makes other lower castes and Muslims in particular feel marginalized? To what extent does that worry you?
I think with the Modi government, the two areas of focus that they've always had and they will continue to have is economic reforms and foreign policy. They definitely want to focus on those two areas. And you could also see that in the swearing-in ceremony where Prime Minister Modi invited leaders from Eastern Asia to sort of show the collaboration that India wants to do under its Act East policy. And the economic reforms that they have already sort of implemented, they're going to work on making sure that those do well. Initially, in the first 5 years, I think a lot of people had said that to fully implement any economic reform in India, in such a large democracy, it will need 2 terms. So we have to wait and see how the next 5 years will play out for economic reforms. And to talk about the situation with the minorities and how Muslims feel, they've expressed their views very strongly against the Modi government and how they fear. But to sort of counter that, again, Prime Minister Modi, he has already encouraged the members of parliament to focus on making minorities feel that they shouldn't fear this, and they will work on changing the perception of the party. So this is what he said immediately after he took office.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, and Nidhi Upadhyay, from whom you just heard. She's Associate Director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council, and we're examining the local, regional, and international ramifications of Narendra Modi's landslide victory in India. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan from none other than New Delhi, India, Ankit Berwal. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We'll back to our discussion about India and turning to you again, Michael Kugelman, to talk about what does it mean, the economic reform? You both have talked about that, but what are the specific reforms that Modi wants to implement? And is there a grand consensus around that across political parties and ethnic and religious groups?
Yeah, well, there's definitely not a consensus within political parties, which is one reason why it was so difficult for the first Modi government to succeed on that level. This is a party that believes in free market liberalism when it comes to economics. So, you know, what the government has tried to do is undertake what you could describe as second-generation reforms, efforts to further liberalize the economy. And this is a process that began back in the early 1990s when India decided to open up to the world for the first time, so to speak, and it's continued. So the types of things that the Modi government had wanted to do the first time was to make it easier to, for example, hire and fire workers. It also had wanted to pass laws that would make it easy to access land for development. Naturally, these are things that are going to run up with some fair resistance from those that would have a different point of view about economics, particularly those from the left, those that are more liberal. And so the government did run into problems. And you certainly, when you take those types of positions, you risk alienating some very key political constituencies, particularly farmers, workers, which are a huge, very significant constituency in India because of their numbers and other things. So I think that what you may see this time, though I'm not exactly sure how this would play out, are some efforts to try to make some adjustments so that the BJP is able to get things done without risking alienating the key constituencies that it did during its first term.
Turning to you, Nidhi Upadhyay, anything to add or subtract with respect to the economic reforms? And also, I'd like you to talk about this Act East foreign policy and how that, you know, affects its foreign partners, India, and what it intends to do in terms of the world.
So I think with economic reform, something that Prime Minister Modi had launched in the first term, like his financial inclusion policy or the Smart Cities Initiative, or even Make in India. These are economic reforms that will not only help the country's economy, but also help him overcome the challenge of unemployment that has been a major point of concern for this government over the last few years. So I think there are certain things that they have already done, but they need to rework how they implement it going forward for things to get better for everybody in the country. And with regards to the Act East policy, it has gained even more importance after the US launched its own Indo-Pacific policy last year. And seeing India as a strategic partner in this, I think the US and India are going to build out their economic collaboration, their infrastructure development on the East Asia side. And that is what is going to sort of promote the economic collaboration for India going forward and make it a regional leader.
And is one of the main reasons behind that to thwart China's rise?
That is what is being said about the whole stand on the Indo-Pacific policy to sort of counter China, if I may put it that way. That is what we've heard the analysts say, and that is what we are seeing overall. But I think India should not be thinking of just countering China. There are a lot of benefits for India as a country if it expands its collaboration to Southeast Asia and the other Eastern nations.
Turning back to you, Michael, what about Pakistan? How do you see relations with Pakistan going forward, especially in the aftermath of the February suicide attack in Kashmir, where more than 40 Indian security officers were killed, and which prompted Modi not to invite Imran Khan to his inauguration? Where do things stand?
Talking about India-Pakistan relations now, it's against the backdrop of what was almost a war between the two countries just a few months ago. So relations are not in that great of a place right now. When Modi took office in 2014, he invited the Prime Minister of Pakistan at the time, Nawaz Sharif, to his inauguration, and he went. There was no way he was going to do that this time, just because I think emotions are still raw from that near conflict between India and Pakistan, and it wasn't the right time to extend the olive branch. And certainly, Modi had got a lot of new mandates in this election. I think one of his new mandates was to continue to take this harder line on Pakistan that his government had taken during the latter part of its term. During the initial years or two of Modi's first term, there were a number of efforts to engage Pakistan. Modi, of course, went to Lahore, Pakistan, in the end of 2015 to meet Nawaz Sharif, the prime minister at the time. And it's only when you started having these terror attacks in India, which were traced back to Pakistan, that's when things went downhill. But it's very interesting to think about India-Pakistan relations. You could argue that Modi is actually the kind of guy that could actually get some progress, get the relationship back on track for several reasons. One, he has that strong mandate, so he can take some risks in reaching out to Pakistan. Two, you know, he has the hardliner credentials. I mean, he's the guy that ordered airstrikes on Pakistan that went across the line of control into Pakistan proper for the first time since 1971. So he's got that. And finally, Imran Khan himself is very close to the Pakistani military. And I think that could be seen as an advantage for the Indians, because they know that if they're negotiating with Khan, that's significant because he's essentially representing the military. Previously, when Nawaz Sharif was prime minister, he was sparring with the military. And I think India thought that it was a waste of time to negotiate with Nawaz Sharif, who was powerless, a lame duck. But Khan is very different because he's close to the military. So we can't rule out the possibility that, as bad as relations are now, they could make some very interesting progress in the coming months.
So, Nidhi Upadhyay, do you think that Pakistan and India can make some progress under Modi's second term?
Definitely. It's because of Prime Minister Modi's stand that we can hope that there will be some progress. Because of the February attacks and the stand that Prime Minister Modi took just for his swearing-in ceremony and going forward, I think it'll be important to see how he interacts with Prime Minister Khan going forward. Prime Minister Khan has also said that he would want to sit down and talk, but Modi is going to make sure that he'll come to the table only when certain demands are met. So I think he is definitely a person in power who can make that happen. But I think we'll have to wait and see how long it takes for them to come to the table and discuss this.
Michael, let's be specific with respect to the points of contention between the two nuclear-armed rivals. I think we can agree on Kashmir. Talk about any progress you see over this disputed region.
You know, I think Kashmir is another area that we have to look to. The Modi government has taken a pretty maximalist position on Kashmir in the sense that it does not seem to be open to the idea of negotiating the status of Kashmir. It believes that Kashmir's status is final. It doesn't need to be negotiated. And this is, of course, a view that's held by many in India. And I think that that could be one reason why this new Indian government would give pause to trying to relaunch talks with Pakistan, because India's government knows that when Pakistan talks about wanting to have dialogue with India, Pakistan wants to do that because it wants to talk about Kashmir, and that's all it wants to talk about. And another big issue is the terrorism problem. India believes that Pakistan has not done enough to go after the terror groups and their networks that threaten and target India. And of course, there have been several specific incidents that have happened just in the last few years, including in Kashmir just a few months ago. So I think that those are the two tricky issues. And of course, India has said very consistently, until Pakistan shows it's taken irreversible steps to deal with these India-focused terror groups, India will not be interested in a serious formal dialogue.
Your take on that, Nidhi Upadhyay, in terms of on the terrorist group side, to what extent you think Khan, you know, will go even further than he's already gone, which isn't very far with respect to dismantling these terror groups, and also on Kashmir?
I think India is waiting to see what Pakistan is going to do, what concrete steps Pakistan is going to take with regards to the terrorist or militant groups. And I think it is very much in line with what global partners and the world leaders are talking about. There's a lot of pressure on Pakistan right now to address the issue, not just for Pakistan's sake or India's sake, but also for Afghanistan's sake, given that you can see a lot of movement of militant groups through Pakistan. And regarding Kashmir, I think it's always been terrible of what is happening there. And India is definitely not going to budge on its claim of keeping Kashmir as part of India. So I think till Pakistan does not make a move or does not talk about what it's planning to do with the militant groups, India is not going to sit down and discuss anything.
And finally, U.S.-India partnership. How do you see that going forward under the second term of Narendra Modi, Michael?
Well, I think it's at a bit of a crossroads. I mean, over the last few years, there's been tremendous progress in U.S.-India relations under Modi and then as well when Trump came to office. But much of that progress has been on the defense side. I mean, that's where the strength of the relationship lies. The economic side has been a very different story. And we've all heard the headlines in the last few weeks that President Trump has taken some very hardline positions on trade. And he's in a trade war with China, one who will be coming with Mexico. He had also slapped some new tariffs on India, particularly in steel and aluminum products. The Trump administration recently withdrew trade privileges for a number of Indian products. So I think that the focus on the U.S.-India relationship now has to be on the trade side, because for a number of years we could say, oh, well, you know, the defense side of the relationship is so strong that these issues on the commercial side, we can overlook them. The relationship will still be strong. But I think that the longer these problems continue on the trade side, you really have to worry about this notion of strategic partnership and how far it could actually go. And I think that President Trump himself is not going to let up on his position on trade, particularly with an election coming up here in just over a year.
So, Nidhi Upadhyay, you get the last word on the U.S.-India partnership.
I definitely think that the strategic relationship is strong, has always been strong, but trade issues have caused the relationship to fracture somewhere a little bit. And I think with the new cabinet in place, things will hopefully start moving forward on the trade aspect of it. But India definitely needs to start focusing on policies that improve the trade relationship rather than just the defense relationship between US and India. And there are a lot of things that they need to work on, a lot of policies that they need to work on that will allow US companies to invest in the country, data localization policy, their e-commerce policy. All of these policies that have been implemented by the Modi government in the first term have not gone down well with a lot of the US companies. So I think there are certain aspects of the trade relationship that need to be worked on, but hopefully with the new external affairs minister, Dr. Jaishankar, and the new cabinet ministers, we will see progress in the US-India trade relationship.
Well, on that cautiously optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, and Nidhi Upadhyay. She's Associate Director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council. Thanks so much to both of you for sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.